It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
Hello, my name is Sloane McLean, and I'm happy to also be a member of the Worship Associates. A year ago today, I lived in Thailand, Southeast Asia. I loved my well-paid, respectable job as head of the Wichai Witia Bilingual School's English program. I had a small but comfortable network of Thai and Western friends. I felt like my soul was thriving in Thailand's community-centered, modest, easygoing culture. Moving to Thailand felt like coming home. But outside, just outside of the ideal Thailand I searched for and embraced, was the reality of my life behind closed doors, the reality of my life with my abusive Thai husband. The more I blossomed in Thailand, the more my husband tore me apart. It wasn't all the time. If anyone has been in an abusive relationship, they know it's down and up. Some days with my husband, nope, were wonderful. We take road trips in our new pickup, driving on country roads, singing John Denver, leading us through temperate forests and breathtaking mountain views. We'd stop at noodle shops, overlooking rice farms, sit on lonely beaches to watch the sunset, stay in luxury resorts with waterfalls outside our windows. Or perhaps we'd stay in town in Chiang Mai and browse the Sunday street festival. But those positive experiences with Nope could not outweigh the insults, the demands, the restraints, the anger, the manipulation that threatened my life at home, at work, at the mall, at the movie, at my friend's house, in the truck, at the cafe, even in our own antique shop. Last March, I planned a trip home to visit my family in Dallas for 1 month. But as March approached, I watched the dysfunction of my marriage as though I were an anthropologist taking notes in someone else's home on the bizarre behaviors that kept this husband and wife together, or rather, were pulling them apart. I knew the honeymoon bond that once connected Nope and I had been replaced by pain, distrust, fear, confusion, and plain disgust. I was coping with my husband to try to keep our family together, to give my son a father. But on March 16th, 2003, I walked through the security gates at Chiang Mai International Airport without my husband and with my baby in my arms. And I felt safe for the first time in months. And I knew I couldn't go back to Nope or to Thailand. And I started to process the reality that I was moving to America, not just visiting it. It was time to get a divorce from the man who locked me in the house so he'd know where I was when he went out for his drunken business meetings, who threatened to sleep with other women on a regular basis, who announced to my colleagues at school that I was an unfit wife and I was unfit to be a mother. And yet today, Thursday, February 5th, 2004, my husband was finally served the divorce papers in Thailand, and I find my heart weeping for him. I'm scared, I'm furious, I'm disturbed by what I've gone through the past few years. But my heart aches for Nope and all other abusers to feel happy and to be loved. Only that can stop abuse in this world. Buddhists believe that all things are connected. It is only an illusion that we are separate from one another. Therefore, if we seek a peaceful heart, let alone a peaceful world, we must practice forgiveness and compassion for all beings, since the peacefulness of our own actions affects the degree of peace in everyone else. By opening our hearts, even toward those who embody beliefs we despise, or toward those who have hurt us, we start to experience the interrelatedness of life. We learn how to work with our anger and fear rather than to get caught up in it. Instead of separating ourselves from what we don't agree with, we take the challenge of transforming and dissolving those conflicts instead. I've been practicing some form of Buddhist Christianity for for the past 7 or 8 years, and it is the teachings of interconnectedness and every moment is a new beginning that help reconcile the pain I have experienced. So often it's my nature to separate life into good and evil, right and wrong, hero and bad guy, as though I understand the difference and the decision is up to me. But no one is completely right or wrong all the time. I can't override my husband's honest actions with his dishonest ones in order to satisfy my image of the bad guy. I do think my husband's actions were wrong, but I don't think I can judge him solely based on his actions during our marriage. Nope had many experiences before he met me, and those experiences and all those he's had since March 2003 make up a man who is more than Sloan's abusive husband. I've learned that if I punish Nope, I hurt myself as much as I hurt him. But what about revenge? A voice inside of me asks. What does revenge really accomplish but pain? I answer. I know from holding grudges in the past that I cannot heal pain with pain. I didn't used to think I needed to make amends with someone who'd hurt me. But why give that person the time of day after what he did? But if I look deeper in my heart, I know the only way to heal my pain is to deal with my pain, work through the pain, not around it. In other words, it's not just for my husband's sake that I'm trying to deal with him compassionately. It's for my sake as well. And in order to fill my heart with compassion, I must start with forgiveness. Forgiveness for the fact that abuse exists in this world. And then forgiveness for the abuser. Nope, Yusupov. Not until I use compassion to forgive my husband can I open my heart to others with the fear that I won't be hurt again. I'm not there yet. My heart hasn't reconciled the pain. My mind hasn't forgiven the memories. But I know in my gut, that's the direction I need to move toward. The more I confront my anger with compassion, the more I can open my heart and free my mind to love again. And if this is accomplished, I'll be able to bring a little more peace into the world rather than hate. And if I can continue to practice forgiveness and face all beings with compassion, my spirit will thrive, just like it did in Thailand.
The center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room for the quiet parts of life. May use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. So often hurt when others sit in judgment on us. Let us remember that we are, all of us, children of God, gifts of life's longing for itself, and that we are precious unto the world. Let us bless our own best selves, but don't stop there. For those close to us are also precious gifts to the world. Let us remember to bless them as well. And all the people we don't know, even those we don't like, even those we may hate, aren't they also precious gifts, even if we don't want to admit it? Can we bless them too? And then where shall the blessings stop? Where can we ever say, no, these people don't count, these we can ignore, we're nothing at all like these? We know that the answer is never, nowhere, and never. If one is precious, all are precious. If one is to be blessed, all are to be blessed. If this is our task in life, and it is one of our tasks in life, let us also remember one more thing. Let us remember to forgive ourselves our lapses of compassion, even as we forgive the lapses of others. For compassion begins there, in forgiveness of ourselves and of others. It begins there. Before we can move toward real blessings, we begin with forgiveness. Let us begin. Amen. When we began talking about this topic, it was very airy and abstract. Sloan had written a guided meditation for her affirmation of faith, and I was going to reflect on Buddhist teachings about compassion. Compassion is a subject the Buddhists probably do better than any religion in the world. It's the central aim and attitude of the religion. It's even its great secret. They have hundreds of things they call metta meditations. Metta is a word that means friendship or loving kindness. The meditations sound simple, but they're only simple if you've never tried them. The metta meditation that both Sloan and Sherry liked has just 5 lines. It says, "May you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you have ease of well-being, may you be safe from danger, may you be free from all suffering." It can sound like the kind of thing little groups of New Agey people would sit around saying and grooving on how marvelously compassionate they all felt. You can hear how it could be used that way, but it isn't a Hallmark card. It's part of a discipline as difficult as any in world religions. First, you say a metta meditation for yourself to heal your own wounds and your own fears. Then you direct it toward the people close to you, to feel one with them. Then you say it for the people you don't like, even the people you may hate, the people who scare you. And then you expand to all people in the world and all life in the universe. Now, somewhere along the line, as we talked about this, I was getting confused by all the abstractions and lost in the clouds. So I asked Sloan why she cared about this and what it had to do with her real life. That's when the story came out, the one that became her second affirmation of faith that you heard just a while ago. And suddenly, it's funny how if just one person gets real, everyone else is forced to get real. And the subject then became very real. And it also became hard to preach on, because the subject is bigger than I am and more expansive and inclusive than I know how to be. I would love to think that I set the curve for compassion. But I suspect it isn't true. Quiet. While reading through that metta meditation, as I went through it several times to try to get a feel for what this was and what we were doing, I tried to imagine at each step that I had that quality of consciousness and care for people near me and far from me and all over the world. And I suddenly asked myself how often or how deeply I had actually thought about, for instance, the 10,000 to 40,000 Iraqi citizens who've been killed since we invaded their country, or the hundreds of thousands of others touched by their deaths. I knew about it. I'd read the stories. But the truth is, I'd hardly thought of them at all. I'm not doing well with loving kindness toward even some of the most recent and dramatic of the world's victims. Closer to home, I asked how often I really thought about all the homeless people begging at every intersection in Austin, about the others that I drive by downtown, about the 5 to 10,000 homeless people I've been told there are here, or even the 50 or so who spent the night here Friday night on freeze night. I know about them, but I hardly think about them at all. Once in a while, I'll put the window down at an intersection and give one of these people $5. But the truth is, if I'm honest, it's usually because it makes me feel better. It's almost never because I'm really thinking seriously about who they are, how they feel, what I or any caring citizen or a caring society should do about it if compassion is to be more than cheap talk. Nor do I really think about the more than 100 million Americans who have no health insurance. Nor do I think much about the fact that we have the highest infant mortality rate in the developed world and what that means to all the families that touches. I know the facts, or that we have the highest youth suicide rate and poverty rate for those over 65 of any country in the developed world. I know the facts. And if you add all the others who are touched by all these people, this has to be more than half our country. It's not a minority. Now, if you corner me, I will claim that absolutely I know those facts. I even mention them in sermons, for God's sake. But if I corner me, then I have nowhere to hide from the fact that I may know the facts, but they seldom touch my heart and have never yet moved me to much significant action. So if a tree is known by its fruits, I'm not a compassionate tree. The word compassion means to suffer with. It isn't even an attractive word. And except for the people whose stories I know one-on-one, I think the hard truth is that I really don't suffer with many people. My best friend died 6 years ago, and I suffered with him. His widow, Marcia, died this Wednesday of breast cancer. And I suffered with her and with their only child, Tyler, when we talked on the phone this week and when I knew yesterday morning at about 11:45 that Tyler would be at the cemetery watching his mother's casket lowered into a hole right next to the gravestone of his father, who died at age 46, right next to the gravestone of his father, who died at age 46. And it's easy to weep for Tyler, knowing that no matter how hard he tries to stop it, he will wonder for the next 20 years if that's all he's got left. And my favorite minister died 3 weeks ago. Fierce, ferocious, wonderful, courageous, honest old man died at 91. I'll miss him forever. If it's close, I'm pretty good at suffering with people. I can't say I like it, but I would say that it enriches me. But if they're very far away, it's pretty hard to feel compassion as anything more than an easy word. Now, maybe you're way ahead of me here. I'm inspired by Sloane's attempt to bless her husband That's a terribly high aspiration, isn't it? It's not the sort of thing we normally think of doing. And it's easy to ask, as she asked herself, why on earth would we want to do such a thing? We don't hear much about really suffering with others. This is not a big American theme. Especially those we're angry with. We hear about beating them, but not suffering with them. And even on a personal level, we hear slogans like, don't get mad, get even. That seems to be American, sort of like a big cowboy movie. And I don't think we have very good models of compassion in most of Christianity either, which is, whether we're a Christian or not, it's still the dominant religion of the culture. I think of Jesus' teaching to turn the other cheek, and I think, what a dumb idea. Jews have said for centuries that that teaching is acquiescence to injustice, and I think they're right. I'm with the Jews on this one. If you're in an abusive situation, for goodness sakes, don't turn the other cheek. It'll just be another target. First you need to get out, then worry about higher goals. It's like the instructions you get on airplanes. In case of an emergency, put your own oxygen mask on first, then help others. And if I don't like that teaching of Jesus, and I think if you want to see some place where that's been lived out, go to a battered women's shelter. I don't like the teaching. But if I don't like that teaching, I think even less of one of St. Paul's famous lines, where he actually says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head. That's Romans 12:20. Now, I'll admit, there's something sort of nasty about that's seductive. It's kind of like a little compassion with a lot of passive-aggressive vengeance. And you sort of get credit for being sweet while you're also really getting even. But I don't think it's anything to be proud of, and it's not a very high aspiration. It helps me when I get in these things to back off and try to get back in touch with basics and try to remember what religion is about, why we come to church, what we're here for in the first place. Well, it's about very basic things, you know. Religion is about trying to become better people, partners, parents, and citizens. It's about trying to make a positive difference in our lives and the lives of those we touch and in the world as we pass through it. Religion's about reconnecting with an attitude toward life that reminds us that we're meant for very high callings and we sell ourselves short if we don't respond to them. Sounds very Buddhist. But the Buddhist version of this, the Buddhist aspirations toward loving kindness toward everyone, they're so high I don't know how to reach them. I fail daily at those. I imagine some of you do too. And I see when I get into this and feel so inadequate, then I understand much more fully why so many Buddhists believe in reincarnation. Because it's going to take more than one lifetime to get this stuff right. I remember a tour guide I had when I was in Bangkok and also in Chiang Mai, when Sloan talked about being at the Chiang Mai International Airport. I was there 2 years ago. I remember what it looks like. It's vivid. And I remember a tour guide we had in Bangkok, wonderful, wonderful, spirited woman, who was telling us about Buddhism and saying the first thing Americans need to understand is that Buddha is not a god. Buddha is a teacher. And then she talked about reincarnation and all this. And during a break, I said, you know, I don't know much about this, but I said, I thought the Buddha had said that the point of it all was not reincarnation, but to get beyond that. Oh, sure, she said. Oh, sure. Sure, she said, the Buddha can do that. The Buddha's perfect. She said, me? I'm coming back. And if I had to take that Buddhist notion of compassion deeply and seriously, and I don't think there's a harder one in the world, I think I'd be wishing I were coming back too. So I thought, for the rest of you Westerners, I would try a different way to talk about compassion today. It's sort of compassion for beginners or Buddhism light. This morning's story about Mr. Hatch was one. It was a wonderful story about a life transformed just because he thought somebody loved him. But another story from my childhood came to mind. It's about a little-known, very little-celebrated bodhisattva named Pinocchio. I hadn't read it in decades, so I went to the bookstore and bought it and had to reread the story, and I'd forgotten most of it. Let me refresh your memory about Pinocchio, in case you'd forgotten some of it too, or you'd only seen the Disney movie, because the original story from the 1830s or 40s is a little different. The old woodcarver, Geppetto, carved a puppet from an amazing piece of talking wood. So Pinocchio, you could say, came into the world as just a block of wood, but one with awesome potential. He didn't actually have strings, even though he was called a puppet. At least not visible strings. But as the Buddhists have taught for 2,500 years, we all have invisible strings. And Pinocchio did too. He had invisible strings that pulled him in different directions like ours do. One set of strings pulled him toward selfish fun, even bratty selfish fun, that hurt those who loved him and trusted him. Goodness, his guardian angel, the blue fairy, even died of a broken heart because he abandoned her. I don't know if that's in the Disney movie. No. And then soon, as you know, he grew those long ears and the tail and he became a donkey. Finally, somehow, Pinocchio was able to respond to the tugs of other invisible strings, strings of compassion. Somehow he seemed to come to his senses. The blue fairy came back to life. Luckily, our guardian angels can be resurrected by a change of heart. He nursed old Geppetto back to health, and in reward for his compassion, the blue fairy turned him into a real boy. The puppet, the book says at the very end, was after all just a piece of wood. The potential was awesome. Now, I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but when I read the story again, I thought, my God, look what this storyteller is saying. In pretty graphic terms, he's telling us that the choices Pinocchio made determined whether he became a human or made an ass of himself. I'm sure he had that in mind. So Pinocchio was a little like a bodhisattva. Still, why should we act really big when others around us are acting really small? Remember the five lines in that metta meditation? May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you have ease of well-being. May you be safe from danger. May you be free from all suffering. It's asking a lot to expect us to feel that way toward the whole world. Be honest. Wouldn't it be more fun when we're angry at people to take St. Paul's spiteful path and act compassionate just so we could dump hot coals on their heads? It's so much easier than really being compassionate. Because that would take an expansion of character rather than just a clever way of getting revenge. And aren't you at least a little tempted by the advice, don't get mad, get even? Haven't you ever done it once? Don't lie or your nose will grow. But think of our little wooden bodhisattva again. When Pinocchio finally acted out of compassion rather than self-centeredness, look how many things happened. It's amazing. It was like the butterfly effect that you read about. Old Geppetto was saved. Pinocchio's guardian angel returned to help him. He became a real human rather than a donkey. He got a story worth telling and a life worth living. It's a profoundly religious story. And we're all a lot like Pinocchio. We all come with strings attached. We must choose which set of strings we'll respond to. But so much depends on what we choose. And our choice has so much creative power. Again, like the butterfly effect, where a little bitty change changes so much. Just thinking of it selfishly, compassion makes so much less suffering for us. Acting out of spite, even St. Paul's self-righteous spite, lowers us to the level of the kind of people who live that way, and that's what we were trying to get away from in the first place. Compassion also surrounds those we care for with fresher air to breathe. Being loving and kind to an ex-spouse we're furious with can be a gift of love and peace to our children who are always standing there watching and learning. And compassion puts so much less poison into the world. It means that we did what we could to become better people, partners, parents, and citizens, and that's our job. In our culture, the notion of having strings attached is seen as a bad thing. But the Buddhists say, and they're certainly right, and that little bodhisattva named Pinocchio showed, that we always come with strings attached. It's our only real hope to become human. If we follow the right ones, and it can help mend our relationships and our world, feeling the tug of those strings. Otherwise, like the little puppet, we too may just wind up making asses of ourselves. Now, this does not mean that you turn the other cheek when the first one's been slapped. It does not mean that you become a patsy for aggressive or passive-aggressive people who build themselves up by tearing others down. It just means that as you act to serve what is precious within you, as you get yourself to a safe place, you try as well to serve what is precious in them, and to see that even as they are acting like donkeys, they are more like you than they are unlike you. They react poorly when they are frightened, just like we do. They can be driven to hurtful anger, just like we can. And when they feel cornered, they sometimes act in ways that no one could be proud of, just like we do. How far and wide must these strings of compassion reach? That's our choice. But those choices determine what we're making of ourselves. Those choices determine what we're making of our relationships. Those choices determine what we make of our world. Perhaps in the end, we are all little Pinocchios trying to lift what is truly human out of what is just a pile of sticks. Like him, If you reduce us to just the cost of our materials, we're not much. But also like him, we come bearing possibilities that are simply awesome. Awesome.